In the matter of State versus Ahmad, may we please have appearances of counsel?
Stephen Van Jura, Assistant Deputy Public Health Defender, on behalf of Zachariah Ahmad.
William Munoz with Whipple Lazzarello, appearing on behalf of Amicus Curiae Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey, as well as the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey and the Northeast Juvenile Defender Center.
Caroline Galda, Special Deputy Attorney General, Acting Assistant Prosecutor, appearing on behalf of the state.
Deputy Attorney General Frank Murawski, appearing on behalf of the Attorney General's Amicus Curiae.
Good afternoon and welcome, counsel. Mr. Ventura, we heard a little echo when you began, so let's see how that starts. We may need to stop you and resume. Please begin.
May it please the court, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
Well, does it sound all right, Your Honor?
It does. Please go ahead. Thank you.
The critical disputed issue in this case is whether my client was in custody for Miranda purposes. There's no question that he was interrogated. There's no question that he was not read his Miranda rights. So this case turns on whether he was in custody and therefore should have been read his Miranda rights. To resolve that question, we reuse an objective standard. Under the totality of the circumstances, would a reasonable 17-year-old have believed that he was free to leave the interrogation, or would he have perceived that his freedom of action was curtailed in any significant way? The lower court applied the wrong test, concluding that because the interrogating officers regarded defendant as a victim, not a suspect, he was not in custody. The proper focus needs to be on what an objective defendant would believe, not an officer's subjective intent. Judged objectively, the facts here overwhelmingly require a finding of custody. Mr. Ahmad was a 17-year-old boy who had just been released from emergency surgery for 4 or 5 gunshot wounds. He was on crutches, in pain, and medicated. He was wearing a hospital gown, and he was told that his clothing had been seized. He was transported in the back of a police car to Newark Police Station, where he sat for hours. He was then transported to the Essex County Prosecutor's Office, in a small interview room with 2 detectives while his parents waited outside the room. He was told the interrogation was being recorded. He was never told he was free to leave. The interrogation began with Detective saying that they were investigating a homicide that occurred at 282 Chancellor Avenue. That was where Mr. Flagg was killed, not where defendant said he had been shot. And while the questioning itself didn't specifically accuse Mr. Ahmad of the homicide, the questioning became very probing. There were a lot of questions that didn't seem to have anything to do with him being a victim, and they repeatedly challenged his version of events. Why he had scratches on his neck, cuts on his hand. They asked him to display his body. The detectives then brought in a crime scene investigator to take photographs of his hands, and who knows what else if his mother hadn't entered the room to stop the interrogation. Under these circumstances, no reasonable 17-year-old would feel free to leave. He was in custody. Furthermore, the defendant was harmed by the admission of his statement. Because this is a constitutional violation, the burden is on the state to prove harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt. The state can't meet that burden for 2 reasons. First, although there was strong evidence that defendant had been inside the cafe, there was no evidence about defendant's role that wasn't contradicted or retracted. Even in the worst version of events, Crawford's statement to police, it was Klein who did all the shooting. So the state's case was strong only on the point that defendant was at the scene. Second, although defendant didn't admit guilt, what he did tell the police was at odds with the physical evidence. Most notably, defendant's blood was found inside the cafe. At trial, the only plausible defense was that defendant was shot by Flagg or Klein or maybe Crawford while defendant tussled with Flagg, but he was not an accomplice in any purported robbery. The only time the jury heard from a defendant was in the video of his interrogation, and what the jury heard about being shot 3 blocks away was obviously a lie. There was little chance that the jury would believe that defendant lied to the police right after the shooting, but did not, in fact, have a criminal level of involvement in Flagg shooting. So Mr. Ahmad was harmed by the admission of the statement, and the state could not establish harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mr. Ventura, can you flesh out some of the sequence that you laid out in your opening statement? Give us a better sense of timing and who the actors were. So let me start specifically with leaving the hospital to go to the police station. Were the parents in the hospital? Is it clear from the record why the defendant was driven in the back of a police car as opposed to with his parents? And when did he arrive at the police station?
So, taking one step back, he arrived at the hospital about 11 o'clock, I believe, and he was in emergency surgery for about 2 hours. It's not clear why he was transported in the back of a police car, but he was. There's no conflict on that testimony. In a Newark
police car.
Were his
parents at the hospital? Were his parents at the hospital? Forgive me for interrupting.
I think that the parents were not allowed to see him until he was discharged. And right when he was discharged, the Newark police said, "You have to come speak with us about the injuries."
I want to focus on this point because I think it's important. Were his parents there at the hospital available to drive him to the police station? Did the police drive him as an accommodation or for some other reason? What can you explain from the record?
Yeah, it's not that clear in this record because it's contradicted or unclear even more so when he's transported from Newark Police Station to the prosecutor's office.
That's there, why I was testimony. Asking the questions because I had the right. same problem with the record. I hope counsel can clear it up for us.
Well, that's sort of a problem with not crediting my client. My client testified that he was told you're coming with us, get in the back of the car, basically. The court didn't find that to be credible, but the court did credit the detective's testimony that he was transported in the back of a police car from the hospital to Newark Police Station, and the record is clear
counsel.
That he sat.
Counsel, I'm focusing on the Chief Justice's questions to you because I have the transcript in front of me. And his mother testified, correct?
She did, Your Honor.
So I'm looking at page 27, and I'm just quoting from it. My son, myself, she had another son, his dad, his brothers and sisters, we exited the emergency room, and I was under the impression that he was going to leave with us, but there was an officer who explained he kept saying that he needed to take him to the police department, and I asked him. That's her testimony. Now, I can quote his testimony. He testified that the police officer said, "You cannot go with your parents. You have to come with me, and you're going in the police car." Wasn't that his testimony?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay, my next question is, did any state's witness contradict either the mother or the defendant? In this
no,
hearing,
on that score, no, there was no direct contradiction.
Okay, so that testimony was uncontradicted in the transcript. That at the hospital, they're there, parents are there, other members of the family are there, he's there, mom's told he can't go with them, and he's told by the officer he's got to go with the police officer to the Newark Police Department. Am I correct?
You're correct, Your Honor.
So
it was not clear.
His credit, but his testimony is not entirely credited by the court. There is an additional piece of evidence in the record from Detective Johnson, who at page 8 of the hearing, I think, says he's assuming that it's the police that brought him from the hospital.
Right, and so that's the ambiguity in the testimony, Your Honor, that there was two versions of events, whether he was transported from the hospital, no, there's no contradiction from the hospital to the police station. That was in the back of the cruiser.
Johnson was not at the hospital. Am I
right.
correct? So Johnson was at the Essex County Prosecutor's Office, and maybe at the Newark, but he was not at the hospital. He was in no position to contradict either the mother or the defendant. Am I mistaken?
I believe that Johnson then went to the hospital after he was told from Newark by Newark police that they had somebody who had been shot on Clinton Place.
Johnson doesn't dispute the parents. That's not why I raised the question. If anything, it sounds as though Johnson is lending support to what you're telling us. Is that correct?
I think that's right, Your Honor. Again, just to show you where there is some divergence in the testimony, it's whether defendant was transported in the back of a cruiser or detective's car from the hospital to the prosecutor's office after having waited 3 hours in the hospital. By one account, he drove with his dad and was escorted by police. By Johnson's testimony, and then he contradicted himself, but by Johnson's testimony, he was in the back and was transported by Johnson and, I believe, Mathis. Then when questioned
Break it down. He goes first to the Newark police station. In the back of a cruiser. Is that accurate?
Yes, and there's no contradiction on that point.
May I ask one question before he leaves the hospital? Was he told before he left the hospital that his clothing was confiscated or seized by the police?
Yes. The mother testified to that fact, that all of his belongings, not just his clothing, had been confiscated.
And just one more point of clarification, since the police were taking him after he had been discharged, is it fair to assume that they were aware of his age and that he was a juvenile?
No question about that. They knew his age, and they obviously knew that he was medicated. He'd been shot 4 or 5 times. He was on crutches and pain, and clearly he was in a hospital gown. At that point, what would have gone a long way is if the detective said, "Mr. Ahmad, you're in a tough position. We realize that you've just been hurt. We want to find who shot you, and we want to talk to you sooner rather than later.
Mr. Ventura,
do you want to go home and talk to us tomorrow?"
Yeah. I'd like for you to flesh out this timeline again, if you could. When does he get to the police station? When does he leave the police station? Who takes him to the Essex County Prosecutor's Office, and when does he arrive there? Can you help us with those details?
Yeah. So let me go backwards. 5 o'clock, he was interviewed at the prosecutor's office. Presumably, he was interviewed shortly after he arrived at the prosecutor's office. He was at the hospital. He was at the police station for 3 hours. So we're back at 2 o'clock when he was discharged from the hospital. So he was in emergency surgery for about 3 hours, maybe 2.5 hours. So he arrived at the hospital approximately 11:30. He was discharged from the hospital about 2, stayed for 3 hours at the Newark police station, just left there in his hospital gown, in pain and crutches, and then brought to the prosecutor's office, either in the back of a cruiser or escorted by police when his father was driving, one or the other.
Was his leg bandaged from his ankle up to his thigh as well?
That's right, Your Honor. He was shot through and through in the forearm, twice in the upper thigh, went through his leg and lodged in his ankle. He was under 5 doses of fentanyl at one point throughout the surgery. So not in a very empowered position to be, you know, refusing to talk to the police if they say, "We've got to speak with you." That's really my point here. When you take into account all of those factors, I think he was in custody right at the beginning. But when you look at the accusatory questioning, when you think about this kid being only 17, it's quite clear that he was in custody. Now, Mr. Morowski,
can I ask you a question? And this is a legal one. Is it for the purposes of your argument, is it not inconsistent that the police officers were acting in subjective good faith that he was a victim, and yet for a 17-year-old in his circumstances, given all that you said, he still was in custody for purposes of the Fourth Amendment and our state constitution?
Absolutely. That's absolutely, to me, that's black-letter law, Your Honor. Now, I would only disagree with the factual predicate to the question. I think that I question whether he was really treated with 100% good faith. But it's absolutely the case that whatever the officer might believe is not relevant to what a reasonable 17-year-old would perceive under the circumstances, unless that's specifically set forth, unless the officer specifically says, "We think you did the shooting," or the officer specifically says, "We know you're innocent here and you can go home anytime you want." If he specifically conveys those things, then what the officer thinking, what he's thinking might be relevant. But other than that, there's no tension between an officer's subjective good faith and a reasonable person thinking that he's in custody.
Mr. Ventura, in light of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in JDB, how should the motion court have considered age in making its custody determination?
I think Mr. Munoz will address that more directly, but I would like to address it as well. There's something special about age that in the JDB court recognized that we all know, we were all kids at one point. We all know that kids do silly things and they're not always circumspect. It's such an obvious fact about an adult versus a child that it does no violence whatsoever to the objective test to consider a defendant's age. The reviewing court should have paid some attention to the fact that this kid was 17. In fact, he had just turned 17, I think, 2 months earlier. So he was a young 17. And nowhere in the court's findings whatsoever was that addressed. Now, I don't think a remand is necessary because I think that this case overwhelmingly shows custody. So I don't think a remand has to be ordered for the lower court to say, okay, would I have come to a different decision had I considered his young age? But it's clear that he should have.
Counsel, I know that the detective said we didn't tell the parents they had a right to be with him because they believed he was a victim and not a suspect. Should our law set forth a clear line that parents have a right and should be told they have a right to be with their child under questioning, whether they're designated victim, suspect, or whatever, and under our case law, AA and pressure?
Yes, Your Honor. So we don't challenge that the court found that defendant's parents were told that the police wanted to speak to him about his injuries, but the actual questioning showed that they were after him for much more. The questioning revealed a lot of skepticism about his story and went well beyond his injuries. In pressure, this court held that courts should consider the absence of a parent or legal guardian from the interrogation area as a highly significant fact when determining whether the state has demonstrated that a juvenile's waiver of rights was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. Now, in this case, the disputed question is custody, not the voluntariness of the waiver, but the rationale of pressure applies here, and as is recognized in JDB. There's something special about kids. They are particularly vulnerable to interrogations. So, Justice Albin, even if this court were to find something less than a deliberate exclusion of defendant's parents, the fact that they weren't in the interrogation room should weigh strongly in support of a finding of custody.
There's a distinction, however, between suspects who are brought into the police station or are asked to come to the police station and victims. Victims may be interviewed on the scene, whether they're injured or they're not injured. Their parents may be miles away. Are you actually suggesting that there be a requirement that a juvenile who is a victim or viewed to be a victim and must have parents present before the police officers can say, who is it that hurt you, who did you see, who shot you, etc.? Is that really what you're saying?
Justice Patterson, my answer to that is a lot like my criticism of Mr. Murawski's position that we determine what a reasonable person would think by looking at what a reasonable innocent person would think. Labeling somebody a victim or a suspect from the detective's point of view is a really unhelpful shortcut. What the officer believes, as I said earlier, unless conveyed specifically to the person, is irrelevant to the objective standard. And circling back to Mr. Murawski's point that I'd like to counter, is that this court has never held that a reasonable, innocent person is the standard under the Fifth Amendment.
But that's not my question standard, for you. My question is considering that victims, maybe, a police officer can respond to the scene of a shooting and find someone on the ground, perhaps not even know he's a juvenile, but if may somehow figure out that he's a juvenile. Are you actually saying that before the police officer can say, who shot you, did you see the people, what do they look like, they must get the parents on scene?
Well, I didn't go that far in my brief. I think that rule could be justified, but that's not the position that I've taken thus far. There are good reasons to have parents there no matter what the officers think. But again, my point is what the officers think is really, it's not that useful. It might be useful for them to as a shortcut for whether or not they should Mirandize somebody, but it's not that useful to determine whether or not the person was actually in custody by a reasonable person standard. As this court recognized in O'Neill, whether a suspect is in custody depends on the objective circumstances, this is a quote, of the interrogation, not on the subjective view harbored by the interrogating officers or the person being questioned. I think that as soon as we posit a reasonable innocent person, or a reasonable guilty person for that matter, we've departed from the objective test. So I think that's a mistake in the same way that the victim-suspect distinction is not as helpful as it may appear at first blush. Because what we have to focus on at all times is what a reasonable defendant would feel under the totality of the circumstances.
If you can, without reviewing the entirety of the circumstances, can you tell us the most significant factors in your mind that point to custody?
Well, being shot, coming out of surgery, and as soon as you come out of surgery, you're in a fog, you're on crutches, you're in a hospital gown, and officers say, hey, we've seized your clothing. Come speak with us. Put in the back of a police car, brought to a police station, and left there for 3 hours. If that's not custody, I don't know what is. But there's more. He's put in the back of a car again, or perhaps escorted by a police vehicle to the prosecutor's office. The questioning got very accusatory, revealed deep skepticism of defendant's version of events. Bringing in a crime scene investigator to take pictures, so many of these things would have put any reasonable person, certainly a reasonable 17-year-old, put them in the mindset that this is not something I can just walk away from. I'm here for the duration. And when the officers say I can go, if they say I can go, is when I can go, not a moment sooner. So I guess a little bit shorter answer is the custody. Right after this terrible shooting, on a lot of medication, put right in a cruiser and brought to, an interrogation room and left there for 3 hours. That's, I think, the most significant. So.
Does it matter? Does the judge's conclusion that he was treated, he viewed the statement, he viewed the video, he heard the testimony, and concluded that he was treated as a victim, not a suspect, is that pertinent here?
So we accept the fact findings of the court, and I think it's not really that pertinent, Justice Solomon, because it shows a focus on something. It shows a focus on the officer's subjective viewpoint.
No, it's not the way I meant it. That's not what I'm talking about. He observed the defendant and concluded, based on his conduct, the questions asked, the way he appeared, what he said and didn't say, that he was treated as, and I don't remember his exact words, but I guess he was concluding that he believed he was a victim and being treated as a victim, not in custody.
Yeah, and Justice Solomon, the exact words were.
Yeah.
Let me answer the first part. The exact words were, based on Detective Johnson's testimony, quote, the defendant was interrogated as a victim of a shooting as opposed to a suspect. So to the extent that matters, that's a legal conclusion that this court should review de novo, whether he was in custody, whether he was a suspect or not. But again, I think it's not all that important unless it's conveyed to him, which it wasn't. And in fact, I suggest by the questioning, the opposite was conveyed to him, that he was, in fact, a suspect. But again, I don't think that's an especially useful shorthand, suspect-victim, because it removes the focus from an objective person under those circumstances.
Counsel, you said the strongest argument for custody was the very beginning, when he left the hospital in the back of a police car. Now, the mother testified what happened at the hospital, and so did the defendant, who said, I thought I was under arrest. In the judge's findings, factual findings, did he ever make any credibility findings that the mother wasn't correct about what she said occurred at the hospital, or that the defendant wasn't correct about what he said occurred at the hospital?
No, his findings were quite vague, Your Honor. He said that, well, the mother obviously has an interest because she's the mother, and she was contradicted because she said she didn't know her son was going to be interviewed, but she also said that...
Now, did he make any credibility findings about what occurred at the hospital, whether or not the defendant's version of what occurred was not credible?
He didn't make specific findings like that. He made sort of swooping findings that I don't find the defendant credible because I watched his video. I don't find the mother credible to the extent that she contradicts or is her testimony conflicts with Johnson's. So it was very
But that is what occurred in the Essex County Prosecutor's Office. It seems that the trial judge was focusing on conflicting accounts then, not about what occurred hours earlier. Am I mistaken?
Well, you're not mistaken. There are no detailed findings, you know, really teasing that out, Your Honor. I think your reading of the court's findings are very reasonable, because the court expressly said, to the extent that she wasn't contradicted, what she said is reasonable, basically, is what she said. So she wasn't contradicted on that fact, so we could, you know, this court could presumably accept that as a credited fact, because the court didn't specifically discredit it. The way that he made his credibility findings in a sort of sweeping fashion allows for that reading to be, you know, fairly offered. Back to the role of parents. I think the fact that they weren't in the interrogation room should weigh strongly in favor of a finding of custody, because I think that under these circumstances, few 17-year-olds would feel free to defy the police, and certainly wouldn't feel free to defy their parents who are waiting outside of the interrogation room expecting their child to speak with the police. So the parents here had almost the opposite effect of what they were supposed to have. Rather than a buffer, if anything, they tended to support a finding of custody. If there are no further questions, I'll just conclude briefly. So the only way the court could have found that defendant was not in custody on these facts is if they applied the wrong test. Examining the detective's subjective viewpoint instead of what a reasonable 17-year-old would have felt under the totality of the circumstances, Mr. Ahmad was clearly in custody by that measure. Mr. Ahmad was also harmed by the admission of the statement. There was no clear evidence of his level of involvement, and a video of him lying to the police seriously undermined the believability of his innocent version of events. More fundamentally, the state bears a heavy burden. Because the state cannot demonstrate harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt, the conviction should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ventura. Mr. Munoz.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. It pleases the court. Mr. Ventura did an admirable job setting forth the circumstances surrounding defendant's interrogation and why those circumstances indicate that defendant was in custody and entitled to a Miranda hearing. Warning, I apologize. The court has already heard at length about those circumstances, and despite all of those circumstances, the trial court and appellate division found that the defendant was not in custody at the time of his questioning. As set forth in the joint brief of the ACDLNJ, ACLUNJ, and the Northeast Juvenile Defender Center, these determinations rest on three errors, each of which, if uncorrected, will erode Fifth Amendment protections for juveniles and adults statewide. Now, two of those errors have already been addressed thoroughly by Mr. Ventura, but the third, which Justice LaVecchia alluded to, is that the lower courts erred in failing to acknowledge that defendant's age was relevant as to whether or not he was in custody at the time of his interrogation. Your Honors, truth matters. It matters in whether a person can vote. It matters in whether a person can drive. Youth matters in whether a person can purchase alcohol or tobacco. And increasingly, over the last 15 years, this court, the United States Supreme Court, and courts around the country have acknowledged that youth also matters in the criminal justice context. Courts have determined that youth matters in sentencing, in areas of due process, and it matters in the protections afforded to a juvenile subject to custodial interrogation. Today, the court's faced with an issue of first impression. Does youth matter in determining whether a juvenile is in custody for purposes of Fifth Amendment and Miranda analysis? And the resounding answer is yes. The question doesn't come to the court in a vacuum. In 2011, the United States Supreme Court issued firm guidance in JDB v. North Carolina and clearly declared that age was a relevant factor in determining whether a young person feels free to extricate themselves from interactions with police and therefore whether or not they are in custody. We don't ask this court to make new law or to expand the reach of existing law. We instead simply ask this court to apply the well-settled case law of the United States Supreme Court. In JDB, the United States Supreme Court observed that, quote, our history is replete with laws and judicial recognition that children cannot be simply miniature adults. JDB 564 U.S. at 274. As that court noted, age and developmental status profoundly affect human dynamics and, in particular, the way one perceives and processes interactions with the police. Social and neuroscience establish convincingly that adolescents are more likely to accede to authority and less able than adults to weigh the risks and benefits of their decisions. Perhaps nowhere is the impact of age and developmental immaturity more keenly felt than in the interrogation room. As early as 1948, the United States Supreme Court declared that in the context of police interrogations, circumstances that would, quote, leave a man cold and unimpressed can overawe and overwhelm a lad in his early teens. Mature men possibly might stand the ordeal, but we cannot believe that a lad of tender years is a match for the police in such a context. That's Haley v. Ohio, 332 U.S. 599-600. For this reason, a juvenile needs, and again, I quote Haley v. Ohio, counsel and support if he is not to become the victim of fear than of panic, lest the overpowering presence of the law crush him. That's Haley, again, at 599. This court's repeatedly extended heightened protections to children subjected to interrogation, including most notably parental presence and consultation before any waiver of rights by children, which was established in Presser and strengthened in State Ex Rel AS 203 NJ 131 and State in the Interest of AA 240 NJ 341. Both this court and the United States Supreme Court have acknowledged the fundamental impact that developmental immaturity has on adolescent judgment, decision-making, and culpability, and those courts have carved out still evolving jurisprudence regarding youth over the last 15 years. These cases recognize that children are simply different from adults. They recognize that youth, simply put, matters. In fact, the JDB court declared that the impact of age and developmental immaturity on perceptions of custodial status is, quote, a reality court cannot ignore, JDB at 277. And the court equated an individual's age, other undeniable, undeniably personal characteristics, such as blindness. Critically, the United States Supreme Court in JDB observed that, quote, a child's age, when known or apparent, is hardly an obscure factor to assess. Though the state and dissent worry about gradations among children of different ages, that concern cannot justify ignoring a child's age altogether. Just as police officers are competent to account for other objective circumstances that are a matter of degree, such as the length of questioning or the number of officers present, so too are they competent to evaluate the effect of relative age. The same is true of judges, including those whose childhoods have long since passed. In short, officers and judges need no imaginative powers, knowledge of developmental psychology, training in cognitive science, or expertise in social and cultural anthropology to account for a child's age. They simply need the common sense to know that a 7-year-old is not a 13-year-old, and neither is an adult. That's JDB v. North Carolina, 564 U.S. at 271. In contravention of the dictates of JDB, neither the appellate division nor the trial court accorded defendant's young age any weight in determining that he was in custody. Yet this lad of tender years had experienced the trauma of gunshot wounds just hours before his interrogation. He was compelled to go from the hospital to a police station in the back of a police cruiser, clad only in a hospital gown, having had his clothing confiscated. After waiting there for some period of time, he was ordered to accompany two detectives to the prosecutor's office, where he was separated from his parents and subjected to a 30-minute accusatory interrogation where even an adult would not have felt free to leave. Certainly no reasonable teenager would have believed they were able to walk out the door in such circumstances. Although JDB is well-settled law, this court has yet to squarely address the centrality of age to the custody analysis in this state. We ask the court to do so here, and on this additional ground, to reverse the decisions below. Thank you.
Any questions, anyone?
One question, Chief. Mr. Munoz, in arguing what you're advancing with regard to JDB, are you in any way seeing this as an expansion of what the court said in PZ, where we said the status of a suspect has to be taken into account in connection with a custody analysis, and status, which I'm at a loss to find explained anywhere else, seems to encompass some objective criteria, perhaps including age, now that we have the U.S. Supreme Court decision. Do you see those two pieces fitting together, or am I reading something into PZ that you do not see there?
I'm not sure if I see it as an expansion. I see them coexisting. I think that the inquiry, as I see it, is, you know, it's simply part and parcel of the totality test. It's just one more explicit factor that the court must take into consideration.
Okay.
In determining whether a juvenile in this case is objectively in custody for purposes of Miranda.
And if we went to a younger age, the argument would be even more compelling. We have a 17-year-old here. If we were talking about a 14-year-old, the lack of judgment, maturity, and wherewithal would be all the greater. Correct?
I believe I agree, Justice Alden. Just like any of these circumstances, there are going to be gradations, as the JDB court acknowledged. Obviously, the younger the juvenile, in a vacuum, all other things being equal, one would presume that it would weigh more heavily towards custody. Obviously, none of these cases occur in a vacuum. I believe that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Munoz.
Thank you.
Ms. Galda.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Our state affords juvenile offenders increased protections under the Fifth Amendment when the juvenile is subjected to a custodial interrogation. However, the petitioner here seeks to extend these protections to a juvenile who was not in custody at the time of questioning and was instead interviewed as the juvenile victim of a shooting and a potential witness to a perpetrator's flight from the scene of a homicide. It was only later, when other evidence linked this defendant to that very crime scene, that defendant himself was identified as a suspect in that homicide. The courts below correctly evaluated the objective circumstances of the defendant's interview and determined that the defendant was not in custody at the time and that his Fifth Amendment rights were not implicated. The lower courts based this conclusion on the finding of several objective circumstances, including but not limited to that the defendant presented himself to officers as a victim of a shooting several blocks from where another man had been killed. The detectives did not ask the defendant any questions whatsoever pertaining to the death of Joseph Flagg, instead restricting their questioning specifically to the circumstances of defendant's injuries, the defendant's parents gave their permission for the questioning, and that defendant was allowed to leave when his mother asked to do so. To quote this court in State v. PZ, these circumstances fail to demonstrate the coercive atmosphere and restraint of freedom that comprises a custodial interrogation. Instead, defendant was clearly questioned in an attempt to gather information during an investigation, and not because he was targeted as a suspect, a situation that plainly lacked the required compulsion to necessitate Miranda warnings. Additionally, I would also like to address defendant's defense claim that the defendant was never informed that he was questioned as a victim. The Detective Johnson testified at both the suppression hearing and at trial that he met with defendant and his parents prior to taking his statement and explained to them that they wanted to question him regarding his injuries because they believed the same individuals who shot him may have committed another crime. Moreover, this court's recent ruling in State v. AA does not apply to these circumstances. In that opinion, this court found that a juvenile who was in custody and made incriminating admissions to his mother while in the presence of police officers was protected from these unwarranted statements being used against him because those circumstances amounted to the functional equivalent of an interrogation. No such functional equivalent occurred here. In AA, the 15-year-old defendant was arrested and taken to a police station where he was kept in a holding cell and the conversation with his mother took place through the bars of that holding cell. This is in sharp contrast to the circumstances here, where the 17-year-old defendant was questioned in an interview room at the prosecutor's office, revealed nothing incriminating, and was allowed to leave when his mother asked to do so. Finally, even if this court disagrees with the lower courts and finds that the defendant was in custody at the time he was questioned, and that a Miranda warning was then required, the state maintains that the absence of the warning amounts to harmless error for two reasons. First, the defendant divulged nothing incriminating during the questioning. Second, the state presented independent and compelling proof of defendant's involvement in the homicide of Joseph Flagg, other than his statement to police. This evidence included security camera footage showing this defendant and his co-defendants fleeing the scene, the defendant's DNA at the crime scene, a match between the ballistics at the crime scene and the bullet removed from the defendant, and the statements of his co-defendants implicating him in the homicide. Under similar circumstances in State v. Tillery, this court found that the admission of a juvenile's unsworn statement was harmless error in light of the compelling independent evidence against him. This court reached that holding because when the evidence was viewed in its entirety, it was extremely unlikely that defendant's statement had an impact on the jury's determination. The same is true here. Therefore, the state urges this court to affirm the decision of the appellate division.
Ms. Calta, would you agree that if a victim is subjected to a custodial interrogation, the victim, like anyone else, would be entitled to Miranda warnings before being questioned?
If the interrogation were custodial, then yes, but I don't agree that it was custodial here, but I think
So the question for us then is to look at whether this 17-year-old, a reasonable 17-year-old rather, would have believed he was free to leave under the circumstances, not whether he was categorized as a victim or in some other fashion. Is that correct?
The objective circumstances test would be what is looked at, but the state's position is that when those objective circumstances are viewed in their entirety, they indicate that the defendant was free to leave.
So help me with the very outset, which is of concern to me. He is taken in the back of a police car from the hospital to the police station. And it appears as though his parents were present, but the police nonetheless took him, victim or otherwise, in their minds, to the station. What is a reasonable 17-year-old to understand from that?
Well, so the circumstances under which he was brought to the police station aren't clear from the record as the defendant claimed, because the trial court decided that that testimony was not credible, but the circumstances once he was at the police station.
Let's stop. Since you're at the hospital, let's stay there. The defendant said this, and from the hospital, where did you go? From the hospital, I thought I was going home, but the officer, he told me I had to go downtown for some questioning. Question, did he tell you why? No, I told him I wanted to go with my mother and my family, and he questioned, and he said I had no choice. I'm not going to read the rest of that page. Was there any testimony, that's on page 51 of the transcript, was there any testimony offered by the prosecutor's office to rebut that statement?
By the prosecutor's office, no.
Yeah, but did you present the Newark police officer who transported the defendant to the Newark Police Department?
No, he did not testify.
Okay, on what basis can that testimony be rejected? And I don't recall anything in the judge's decision commenting on this account that he gave at the hospital. Go ahead.
On that specific account, the judge, I would agree that he didn't mention that specifically, but he found that the defendant was inconsistent on many points, not just with the testimony of Detective Johnson, but with his own testimony. He contradicted himself, and the trial court was in the best position to evaluate his testimony, demeanor, everything to determine.
It wasn't just his testimony. With respect to the hospital, it wasn't just his testimony, it was his mother's too. Same thing. That was unrebutted, no?
The court assessed credibility when they found it not credible, the trial court?
Let me get to see this in answer to this, and then please answer Justice Fernandez Venus. Was the mother and son's testimony about what happened at the hospital unrebutted?
Not by the state, but the defendant's mother herself, she left the hospital separately. She wasn't present for these events. So she's her credibility, like the trial court determined, was in question, and as well as that she's biased as the defendant's mother.
Can you answer Justice Fernandez-Vino's question? Yeah. Unless you've just done so.
No. Well, maybe. I don't know. I just wanted to know.
I'm sorry,
did the judge make credibility assessments there live, or how did the judge make the determination that it wasn't credible? Because that wasn't clear to me.
I'm sorry. I'm not sure I'm understanding.
Did they testify before the judge as to these issues?
Yes, they testified during the suppression hearing that this was the sequence of events as they claimed that they occur, and the judge found that testimony wasn't credible.
Okay. I wasn't clear to me if that's what happened.
Does he say that? I'm sorry. Where in the judge's decision does he find that the mother's testimony and the son's testimony about what occurred at the hospital was not credible?
Well, again, I can't point to him mentioning specifically that the testimony as to the hospital was not credible, but that their testimony, testimony as a whole was not credible. He didn't go through their testimony point by point and say it wasn't credible.
Is there any dispute in the record that it is the police who drive the defendant from the hospital to the police station?
In the record, no. There's dispute as to from the police station to the prosecutor's office.
So as to the first trip, can you, based on the record, help explain why it is that the police and not the parents took the defendant from the hospital to the police station?
That I am not certain. As I said, the defendant's mother was not present. She left with their other children. I don't know why he wouldn't have been driven with his father. I do know that the detectives who would eventually question him were at the crime scene at the time that this was going on. That's from the testimony at trial on April 19, 2017, on pages 45 and 56 through 58, that was where they were at the time that he was waiting at the police station.
If he was a victim, why wouldn't he put a victim who's on crutches, his entire leg is wrapped up, he's been shot three times, at least five doses of fentanyl. If he was a victim, why wouldn't the police permit his mother or his father drive him to the police station?
That I don't really have an answer for directly from the record, other than maybe for some reason that was the best option. We don't have an answer one way or another from the record.
Or why wouldn't they let him go put on some clothes as opposed to just a hospital gown? I mean, don't you think that, again, it's already been reiterated, but a teenager who was just shot multiple times coming out of surgery, the first thing that happens is that he's taken in the back of a police car to be questioned. Don't you think that factors into the determination of whether he thought he was in custody as a 17-year-old?
I think it factors into the decision, but we have to look at all of the objective circumstances. But also, with respect to Your Honor's point about his clothing being collected, I do want to point to the testimony of Detective Johnson at trial from April 19th of 2017 at page 6. Where he stated that the defendant's clothes were collected at the prosecutor's office after the defendant gave his statement. Not at the hospital.
Does that mean he was wearing them, or that they were just taken at that point?
I believe that he was wearing the pants. At trial, there was testimony that he and one of the other co-defendants had switched clothing on the way to the hospital. So the original clothing that he was wearing was never recovered, but the clothing that he was wearing when he was at the hospital, according to Detective Johnson, was collected at the prosecutor's office after he gave his statement.
So as far as we know, he was clothed when he left the hospital and then we left the prosecutor's office. Is that right?
Yes.
And
there was a dispute. There was a dispute as to whether his father drove them to the prosecutor's office or he went with the police to the prosecutor's office. I take it.
Yes. And that's, yes. And the defendant judge, him. Sorry.
Go ahead. Say what you're going to say.
The defendant's testimony, he was inconsistent on that point himself at one point, stating that he was transported to the prosecutor's office by the police, and then at another point stating that his father drove him.
And the police, did the police testify? Did the cop testify that he was driven by his father to the police station?
At the suppression hearing, Detective Johnson said that he couldn't recall specifically. At trial, his testimony was that they escorted him and his father to the prosecutor's
office. Did the judge make any finding in that regard at all? How he was got from the police station to the prosecutor's office?
I don't believe so, no.
Is it disputed then what was said before that the defendant was told at about the time he was leaving the hospital that his clothing was seized by the police?
Well, again, the trial court found that the defendant's testimony wasn't credible, so I would point to that, and also that it's not what was testified to at trial by the detective.
I mean at the motion.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree that would be in dispute, that's not accurate, but again, that testimony was found not to be credible.
And do you have a citation for where in the suppression hearing that was contested?
I think I may have, maybe not, should clarify. It wasn't, that point itself wasn't contested at the suppression hearing. I'm saying that there is a discrepancy between what the defendant testified to at the suppression hearing, which was found not to be credible, and the testimony that was given at trial about when his clothing was collected.
No, the defendant testified he was in his gown when he left from the hospital to Newark and from Newark to the Essex County Prosecutor's Office, correct?
Yes, that was correct, the defendant's testimony.
Did the officer ever say he wasn't in a gown when he was questioned?
To my recollection, I don't think he was asked the question as to what the defendant was wearing.
And his entire leg was bandaged from his ankle to his thigh, which might have made it difficult to even get his pants on. No?
Possibly.
Okay.
Yes.
Ms. Galton, when he gets to the prosecutor's office and is interviewed, that interview is videotaped, we know, correct?
Yes. Yes, it was videotaped.
Can you tell us, is it a requirement? Is it a practice? Is it within the discretion of the police to videotape a witness, a victim who's come forward, a juvenile victim who's come forward to give a statement?
To be honest, Your Honor, I'm not sure, but I generally, from the cases I've seen, think that it's fairly common in our office to record the statements of victims.
Maybe Mr. Murawski can help us.
Have you seen the videotape, Ms. Calder?
No, as it was not part of the record below.
Other questions, anyone? Is there anything you'd like to add, Ms. Calder?
No, not at this time.
Thank you. Mr. Murawski.
Thank you. May it please the court. The Attorney General would like to just clarify something that the state said and maybe even disagree with it. But if someone maintains the status of a victim and their status of a victim has not changed to that status of a suspect, custody determination, as understood by Miranda, does not apply to him. So I guess the Chief Justice asked if can a victim be in a custodial situation, not in a Miranda custody situation. Miranda custody only.
So hypothetically, if a police officer says, look, you are a victim here, but you're not going anywhere. You have to stay, and you have to answer my questions, and you're going to sit here in this interrogation room. Miranda warnings or no?
Well, if he's a victim, if he's clearly a victim of a crime, and he's not being suspected of incriminating himself, you see, the purpose of the Miranda warnings is that someone not incriminate himself. And if someone is genuinely a victim, it's difficult to see how they could incriminate themselves. The whole purpose of the Miranda.
Supposing the officer says, just to strip it to the raw essence, and then please give me your answer. Supposing the officer says, you are not free to leave, even though at this moment in time we're treating you as though you're a victim. You're going to answer my questions. Are Miranda warnings required under those circumstances?
Well, it would depend if the questioning morphed into an accusatory situation. If the officer said to him, we're treating you as a victim, but we don't think you're telling the truth. We think that you had a gun with you. We think that you were the aggressor. If the nature of the question changes the status of the victim into a suspect, then that would generate the need for Miranda warnings. But if the officer continued to ask him, who shot you? Who shot you? Suppose he's investigating a serial murderer and he wants to know, who shot you? Who shot you? I don't want you to go home until you tell me who shot you. We may or may not like that, but it doesn't kick in Miranda. We ask the court not to blur the line.
So I don't see anything in Miranda that goes to a subjective inquiry concerning whether a person is a suspect or whether or not the person is a victim. The Miranda warnings kick in when there is custodial interrogation, and custody is determined based upon the totality of the circumstances. And why should we apply anything less than that constitutional standard? Because victims typically are not coerced to stay in a particular place to answer questions.
Victims can be. Maybe not coerced, but police can sometimes want to encourage victims to talk because, unfortunately, the police are often confronted with victims and witnesses who are reluctant to talk to the police and be fully candid for a variety of reasons. Retaliation, unfortunately, mistrust of the police. There could be a variety of reasons why a victim does not want to be fully candid, and the police may want to be a little forceful and say, tell us. I don't want you to go home until you tell us who shot you. We need to know who shot you. There's a madman on the loose. We need to know. There's nothing wrong with the police trying to cajole and convince of
So no one's suggesting that, and I wouldn't suggest that for a moment. But in a circumstance where, under the totality of circumstances, an objectively reasonable, let's say 17-year-old, would not believe that he had a right to leave, why doesn't that immediately trigger, you can't use it under Miranda, if you don't give Miranda? Continue to question the person, that's fine. You may be subjectively acting in good faith. You just can't use it under the standards set forth both in federal jurisprudence and in our state jurisprudence.
Well, if the police did nothing to violate Miranda and its progeny, there should not be an accompanying suppression rule for reasonable police investigative questioning. And if the police are reasonably questioning a victim or an eyewitness for investigative purposes, Miranda should not kick in. Now, we also dispute the fact that he was actually not free to leave. Of course, we'll defer to
the state. Let's say you don't dispute that. He's an actual. Do you think it's okay for the police to place in custody victims, to actually tell victims, under no circumstances can you go, and you're not leaving this interview room. We're going to stay here from morning till night until you answer my questions. Is that permissible?
Well, if there's an extreme situation that is not presented in this case, perhaps a record and a proper briefing can be applied, and perhaps there could be other remedies. But the question is, does Miranda and Miranda's accompanying suppression rule apply? The police should be allowed to be more should not have to be rigidly applied Miranda when talking to a victim or witness, because they're not, if he's telling the truth, he's not in jeopardy of incriminating himself. He just might be reluctant to talk to the police for a variety of reasons.
How could a rule that broadly required victims to be Mirandized just in case something happens affect the ability of police to investigate crimes and speak to people who are nothing more than victims?
Well, we as we cited in our brief, as found by the Department of Justice, that just treating a victim or an eyewitness as a suspect by reading them the Miranda warnings could have a stifling effect. It could have a chilling effect on that person from being fully candid. Because if someone, you know, if they're not well-versed in the law and they want to tell the police, hey, I've been sexually assaulted, I've been shot, and the first thing the police say, you have the right to remain silent. Everything you say can be used against you in court. They might clam up. They might stop talking. And the Department of Justice...
Isn't the core question then whether the person has been subjected to custodial interrogation? Because if somebody's brought in and encouraged to testify, encouraged to give information, and they're a victim, then stands to reason, Justice Patterson is right, they don't have to be given Miranda warnings. Isn't the question whether they've been subjected to a custodial interrogation?
Well, the custodial question is entirely different. Even if relevant at all, it would be completely different from the custodial situation of a suspect. The police can say things to victims and eyewitnesses that they probably couldn't say to a suspect. Like if an eyewitness says, I don't want to talk to you anymore, the police can continue asking him questions. We know they can't do that with a suspect. If an eyewitness or a victim says, I want a lawyer, the police don't have to get a victim a lawyer. I mean, they could if they want. It would be nice, maybe. But the law does not require that. There's a lot of things that are not required of the police when talking to a victim or an eyewitness as opposed to someone who's a criminal suspect. Now, I want to address
Mr. Morosky, no one's saying that the police have to give victims Miranda warnings. The only question is, if they subject someone to a custodial interrogation under our constitutional jurisprudence, then you can proceed. Well, you can still question, and you can't use it, or you can give Miranda. It's as easy as that.
The term custody and the term interrogation of the person being questioned. Okay, if you come into the police station and say, I've been shot, I'm a victim. And the police say, come on into this room. We're going to tape record your statement. Don't leave until we get everything we need. Come on in. That's a lot. They can do that to a victim. They could do that to an eyewitness. If a suspect comes in and wants to confess, the police can't say, all right, we're going to question you now and you can't leave. They could treat a victim or eyewitness substantially different. And the Attorney General is concerned that if we start importing strict Miranda regulations into discussing with a victim or eyewitness a legitimate investigative questioning would cause too many problems than they would solve. And we ask the court to keep it very clear line of demarcation.
And it also could cause people not to seek help from the police because they think they're instantaneously being turned into suspects, and that may be at their peril. Isn't that
exactly
also an issue? Yes, that you're right.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, so.
But I think you're creating like a straw man. No one's saying that the police ever have to give Miranda warnings to a victim. Okay, you just don't have to, who you believe is a victim. But if you're engaging in a custodial interrogation, if it winds up being a custodial interrogation, you can still question, get all the information you want. You're just not going to be able to use it if you've turned it into a custodial interrogation.
Well, that's not the purpose of Miranda is to not extract incriminating information from a suspect in a custodial setting, to not ask questions. Like if you ask questions of someone about their victimhood, who shot you, why did they shoot you? That's not custodial interrogation. Even if the police are locking somebody in their room and just ask them, who shot you? Who would want to hurt you? That's not interrogation under Miranda.
Let's not use a hypothetical. Let's use this case and assume certain facts. The kid has been shot a number of times, is on a high degree of medication, fentanyl, okay, is told by the police he's got to go on a police cruiser. His leg is bandaged. His clothes are taken from him. He's in a hospital gown, and he's driven. Custody?
No, Your Honor. The fact that he's shot and bandaged is a result of him deciding that he wants to engage in a robbery, which turned into a murder. So, you know, you have to be careful which the sympathy we accord people. We have to look at things objectively. And objectively speaking, just because you're put in a police car doesn't make you in custody. I cited the Marshall cases when Marshall was taken to the police station by a state trooper in a troop car. He was not considered in custody at all at that point. Just being transported to the police station in a police car does not make it custody. In fact, it's not even very indicative thereof. It's of course it's part of the totality of circumstances, but it is not dispositive. And so the fact that someone is taking from a hospital to the police station or to a prosecutor's office in a police car, and I don't know if the testimony was that it was marked or unmarked. Who knows why the police did that? They probably had a reason to do that, to ensure that this witness got to the police station. Maybe it was safer in their car than in his family's car. I mean, there could have been a variety of reasons, but the fact of the matter is it is not dispositive to the custody determination. No, he was not in custody because he was never subject to custodial interrogation. We disagree with Mr. Vangiro, who says the questioning was accusatory. It never was, and the judge made a fact finding to that effect. We urge the court to follow what it said in Hubbard and follow the fact findings of this trial judge, who said not only did the officer think he was a victim, but he questioned him and treated him as if he was a victim. The officer converted his subjective beliefs into objective action, and that becomes very relevant to whether this is even custody or whether it's interrogation. They never interrogated him as understood under Miranda. We asked the court to keep a very clear line between witnesses and victims.
Speaking of lines, Mr. Morosky, there was discussion earlier in the argument this afternoon about extending the AA protections and pressure protections that apply to juvenile suspects when they are being interrogated or when they're in a custodial setting to victims. What are the practical implications of requiring parental presence when a victim, juvenile, is a victim and is being questioned?
Because a victim, to require parental presence might impede the legitimate investigative questioning, because even victims and eyewitnesses may not want to be fully candid as to where they might have been, who they might have been with, what they might have been doing. If their parent is there, sometimes the parent can inhibit a full candid discussion. Now, that's important when it's a suspect. Miranda says that's important. That the pendulum shifts in the other direction, where that parent should not be there if it's going to inhibit that eyewitness or victim the police
investigation. So take this case. You're saying he's being treated as a victim. His parents don't have to be called to the prosecutor's office. They're there. They're right there. Why shouldn't parents of a victim have a right to be in the room when their victim's son is being questioned? What's wrong with that?
Well, it's wrong because it could, like I just said, it could inhibit the victim the eyewitness from being fully candid, because victims and witnesses are not always eager to talk to the police, as we know, unfortunately, for a variety of reasons. And the police want them to be fully candid. And they, if understanding that they're a legitimate victim or eyewitness, they're not in jeopardy of incriminating themselves. They're not going to incriminate themselves. So there's no need for the parents. Precious says they should be there for the critical waiver determination. The waiver determination is irrelevant if you're a legitimate victim or witness. So there's no waiver determination where you need a parent's advice for. And it also says when the police investigation becomes in contradiction to the juvenile's interests, the parent should be there.
Well, the
assuming
police,
it is a legitimate victim.
Had the parents been in that room, they made us stop that questioning early on. Look, the mother, from outside the room, when she saw someone coming in with a camera or some other device, said, "Hey, what's going on?" and pulled her son out. Like, why should we have spoken about an AA and pressure, about the safeguards that parents provide to their They're underage children. Why shouldn't they be providing it in circumstances like this?
First of all, again, a clear demarcation has to be made between criminal suspects and presumably innocent victims and eyewitnesses. That the parent, and if you look at the facts here, the parents were asked permission. They did ask the parents permission, and the juvenile and the defendant knew they were there. In Prussia, this court said the fact that he knew his parents were there and he could have asked to talk to him at any time was part of the totality of circumstances.
Well, what about the practical implications? Prussia obviously requires the parent to be told, or at least an effort to be made to be told, that the child is in, the juvenile's in police custody. What are the practical implications of a rule that would require parents to be notified before a victim is questioned?
Well, it could be delay. The delay of finding important information of a criminal who could be, police could get caught on their trail. If they require a victim or an eyewitness to have a parent available before they question the victim or eyewitness, they could lose the opportunity to capture a violent criminal. Also, as I said before, it can inhibit the free flow of information. And sometimes it is the parent who is the suspect that's being reported on. So you have to be careful that it could be someone, a guardian or a parent, who could be the person that's being reported on. Now, if they're reporting that, then why would you require that parent to be there? I realize that's not in every case, but that could be a factor. So there's a variety of reasons you don't want to delay or inhibit the investigation of an eyewitness and a victim. You want to encourage victims and eyewitnesses. The police can deal with victims and eyewitnesses a lot differently than they deal with suspects. And to cause the Miranda rule to be imported into the discussions of victims and eyewitnesses would just have a terrible consequence and not provide any benefit. If this case was from an honest victim, this would have been an unremarkable investigative conduct by the police. It only becomes important because the defendant was lying about the circumstances of those wounds. Most reasonable people would probably want to help the police find the person that pumped three bullets into them. Most reasonable people would want to cooperate with the police. Most people would want the police to be eager to get information and to be full and to get their record. The police did not translate anything into a custodial situation by their conduct, by the facts. I mean, again, I can't emphasize enough that subjective belief by the police was converted into objective action, as found by the trial judge. We asked the court to rely on the trial judge. Now, there were some questions about the defendant's testimony being unrebutted. There is no axiom of appellate review that says if the defendant's statement is unrebutted and the judge finds him unreliable, then you have to accept it anyway. I mean, false in one, false in all. A judge can find a defendant not credible, and nothing he says should be used by a reviewing court, rebutted or unrebutted. That's really irrelevant to a reviewing court.
Can I ask you a couple questions, Murawski, Mr. Murawski? I hate to interrupt you. Take a deep breath if you need to. These are just very, very ordinary questions that actually bear upon this case and not hypotheticals. Okay. The parents were present. Did they ever ask to be present during the interrogation?
No, they didn't, but she barged in and stopped it.
Okay. And when they did see the photographer going in, they stopped it and he was permitted to leave, correct?
He went home with his parents.
Is it relevant whether the police believed and acted as if he was a victim rather than a suspect? Is that relevant to our determination here?
It is relevant to the extent it was projected to the individual. I mean, if the police thought something but didn't act or convey those beliefs, then that would be completely irrelevant. But
did that's all I'm getting at. If the police believed and acted as if he was a victim and not a suspect, is that relevant?
Very relevant. It's the spot. Right,
okay. Did the defendant, in fact, throughout this interrogation, maintain that he was a victim?
He did indeed. He never. He always maintained.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish.
He always maintained that he was an unexplained shooter, shot him. He didn't know why. but he never suggested anything that he had started this, deserved this, was part of something. The entire questioning was around who did this to you, who would want to do this to you, who was with you at the time. And every answer to that question was consistent with those questions by the police.
From the beginning to the end of the questioning, did the police ever say, or did anybody else ever say, that he was in fact in custody and not free to leave?
Never. It was never said to him.
And the trial judge said that in his decision and relied on that in some part. Is that correct?
He did. He did indeed. Nothing was said to him, nor did he was he denied the ability to take a break, or to talk to his parents.
He never asked.
To do anything.
But he never asked.
He never asked him. And remember, this is a 27-minute interview, so it's not a lengthy interview. That's an important question in the custody calculus. It's only 27 minutes. He knows his parents are outside the door. He knows he's telling the police he's a victim. He knows that. That's a very important part of the calculus. He's maintaining this posture as a victim. So there's no reason why he should think that the police are treating him anything other than that when they are asking him questions consistent with his lie. So he's the one that's generating.
So Mr. Vinger, and what I was trying to get at, Mr. Vinger's argument has been the police, whether reasonable or not, and I think we're conceding or assuming they acted in good faith, the belief, reasonable, that he was in fact a victim is irrelevant. And you dispute that out of hand.
Well, just the naked belief by itself without anything else is irrelevant. But when that belief is translated into questioning and treatment, then it does add credibility to the judge's fact.
I'm presuming when I ask you the question, I understand you're putting the qualifications on it. I give you credit for that. I'm presuming when I ask the question that the judge reviewing the video and seeing the testimony and the police testimony and all the evidence indicates that, in fact, they were acting as if, and the police believed, consistent with his defendant's contention, that he was a victim. And so you disagree with Mr. Vanjura's position that, under those circumstances, is irrelevant. You think it's relevant.
Well, here it is. If it was never
That's
communicated.
What I'm talking about here. I'm not referring to any other cases. I'm just referring
relevant.
To this.
Here it is relevant because it informs the conduct that took place in those 27 minutes. Here it is consistent with that conduct, and it lends credibility to the fact findings that the officer honestly believed this, and that's the way he treated him. So when you have conduct, when you have the beliefs backed up by conduct, those beliefs count for a lot more than if it's just beliefs that the officer kept to himself.
Mr. Murawski, do you know the answer to the question I asked Ms. Galda earlier? Is there a policy or a practice or a rule about whether a witness or a victim who's a juvenile is videotaped?
Your Honor, I do not know the answer to whether there's a practice or a policy, but I could certainly say that it's objectively reasonable to preserve a victim's or witness's statement through videotaping. So, I can't inform the actual practice question, but I certainly could sit here and say that it is objectively reasonable for police to do that. I mean, because what's more reliable in court? I mean, the video statement or the officer's testimony? I think we've all come to the conclusion that we prefer to have videos. Officers have been trained recently that videos are better than just memory. So, and interestingly, in this case, he was told he was on video. So they don't always have to tell suspects that they're being videotaped. He was told he was being videotaped.
Let me give you another rational reason, perhaps, that it's videotaped. And you tell me if you've ever heard this or experienced this, that an apparent victim who's just been shot multiple times and is still alive and is being interrogated and giving you what you believe is some information that might be relevant to determine who the shooter was, might not be around to give you another statement or be around when it goes to trial. And that would be a reason why a reasonable, intelligent, hardworking prosecutor would in fact videotape that statement by a witness. Is that a rational conclusion?
That's entirely
Does that happen in practice?
It does happen in practice. So that happens in practice. Witnesses may not be around, or they could be around, but they change their story because they've been intimidated.
That too.
So, and there's, and also that they want it as it was the freshest in everybody's mind as to when it happened. There's a multitude of objectively sound reasons why this should be done. Now, as far as the actual practices are concerned, I do not have that information.
Go ahead.
I just want to talk about, there was a lot of statements that the parents weren't permitted. There's nothing in the record that says the parents were not permitted. The officer's testimony was, I just want to ask him about his injuries. You don't need to be in there. The officer said, you don't need to be in there. He didn't say you can't be in there. So
Mr. Morosky, it's something the defendant said in his testimony. He said, I'm 17 years old. I don't know what the law is. I didn't know I had a right to leave. And the parents may not have known that they had a right to be present. It's just that it's simple.
Well, it's okay, also simple that he's a victim. He's a victim here, and victims don't need the full, you know, arsenal of rights that are brought to bear on a criminal suspect. That would cause more harm than it solves. And you know, of course, the relative youth is part of the totality of circumstances. If he indeed is a suspect, a criminal suspect, but when you're a victim and an eyewitness, the police should be governed by principles of sound investigative procedure rather than rules that discourage the free flow of information. The police should not be hidebound by rules that are designed to protect someone's rights when their rights aren't implicated. The rights aren't implicated when you're a victim or a witness. Now, if you lie in when you come into the police station, that is not the police officer's fault, nor should the police have to presume, oh, you might be lying, so I'm going to read you Miranda. That's exactly what we don't want to do. We don't want to treat people like they're criminals. We don't want to treat people like they're suspects. We want victims and witnesses to candidly discuss things. And there's nothing wrong with the police applying a little pressure on victims and eyewitnesses to talk. Now, it could be said, we're not saying they can't talk to witnesses. Well, they can talk to witnesses in a more, I guess, cajoling, forceful situation than they can talk to a suspect. An officer can put them in a room and say, please tell us. Before you leave, I want you to tell us. Who shot you? Who did you see anybody? That's different. It's night and day. Talking to a victim or eyewitness is legally like night and day to talking to a suspect. That informs the custody question. It informs the the interrogation question. It informs both sides of that Miranda analysis, and it is like night and day. And we ask the court that the first question should be, is he being treated like a victim or a witness of which he is fully bringing to the table? He is the one part of these objective circumstances. He's creating these objective circumstances by how he's presenting himself. Under these objective circumstances,
I want to understand the scope of the argument you're making now. If the answer to that threshold question that you just posed is yes, he's being questioned as a victim, is that the end of the analysis? Is there no review of the totality of the circumstances once that question is answered? I'm not sure I follow what your position is.
If the questioning that starts off as innocent questioning of a victim or witness morphs into the accusatory question of a criminal suspect, then the circumstances change. The status of that person changes, and then Miranda warnings would be necessary. But if the questioning remains that of a victim or witness and it does not ask incriminating questions, then whatever else we may want to do, Miranda and Prescia do not apply. This would be a dramatic extension of that law.
Then likewise, and tell me if you disagree, in addition to looking at what follows after the questioning begins, is it appropriate to consider what has taken place before?
Certainly in the totality of circumstances, but those circumstances have to be more than just, well, you're in custody, you're in our police car, we'd rather you not leave. The circumstances have to be, we think you're guilty of something, and you are subject to custodial interrogation, and custody has been determined of to a degree associated with formal arrest. Custody is like, you're not going home soon. It's not like, oh, and we're done talking to you, you can go home with your parents. That's not custody. So, yeah, you could look at the totality of circumstances, but those totality of circumstances have to be specifically geared towards is this person a suspect, or are they being asked interrogating, incriminating type questions? And if the answers to those questions remain no, then he is not entitled to Miranda, even if he's in a circumstance where he doesn't feel free to leave. I mean,
I think we've now covered the issue at great length, and we're a little bit beyond your 5 minutes. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor, other than to affirm the appellate division's ruling.
Thank you. Mr. Van Jura, did you want to offer a brief rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.